8. The same old guy dragging the meal cart. I ate the breakfast and drank the coffee. As I finished up the flask, the gate lock clunked and sprang the door. I pushed it open and stepped out and bumped into a guard, aiming to come in.
"It's your lucky day," the guard said. "You're getting out."
"I am," I said.
"You both are," he said. "Reacher and Hubble release by order of the Margrave PD. Be ready in 5 minutes, okay?"
I stepped back into the cell. Hubble had hauled himself up onto his elbows. He hadn't eaten his breakfast. He looked more wary than ever.
"I'm scared," he said.
"You'll be okay," I said.
"Will I?"
he said.
"Once I'm out of here, they can get to me."
I shook my head. "It would have been easier for them to get you in here," I said. "Believe me, if they were looking to kill you, you'd be dead by now. You're in the clear, Hubble." He nodded to himself and sat up. I picked up my coat, and we stood together outside the cell, waiting. The guard was back within 5 minutes. He walked us along a corridor and through two sets of locked gates, put us in a back elevator, stepped in and used his key to send it down, stepped out again as the doors began to close.
"So long," he said. "Don't come back."
The elevator took us down to a lobby, and then we stepped outside into a hot concrete yard. The prison door sucked shut and clicked behind us. I stood face up to the sun and breathed in the outside air. I must have looked like some guy in a corny old movie who gets released from a year in solitary. There were two cars parked in the yard. One was a big, dark sedan, an English Bentley, maybe 20 years old, but it looked brand new. There was a blonde woman in it who I guessed was Hubble's wife, because he was on his way over to her like she was the sweetest sight he ever saw. The other car had Officer Roscoe in it. She got out and walked straight over to me. Looked wonderful, out of uniform, dressed in jeans and a soft cotton shirt, leather jacket, calm, intelligent face, soft, dark hair, huge eyes. I had thought she was nice on Friday. I'd been right.
"Hello, Roscoe," I said.
"Hello, Reacher,"
she said, and smiled.
Her voice was wonderful. Her smile was great. I watched it for as long as it lasted, which was a good long time. Ahead of us, the Hubbles drove off in the Bentley, waving. I waved back and wondered how things would turn out for them. Probably I would never know, unless they got unlucky and I happened to read about it in a newspaper somewhere.
Roscoe and I got into her car. Not really hers, she explained. Just a department unmarked she was using. A brand new Chevrolet something, big, smooth, and quiet. She had kept the motor running, and the air on, and inside it was cool. We wafted out of the concrete yard and shunted through the wire vehicle cages. Outside the last cage, Roscoe spun the wheel, and we blasted away down the road. The nose of the car rose up, and the back end squatted down on the soft suspension. I didn't look back. I just sat there, feeling good. Getting out of prison is one of life's good feelings. So is not knowing what tomorrow holds. So is cruising silently down a sunny road with a pretty woman at the wheel.
"So what happened?" I said after a mile. "Tell me."
She told me a pretty straightforward story. They had started work on my alibi late Friday evening. She and Finley. A dark squad room, a couple of desk lights on, pads of paper, cups of coffee, telephone books, The two of them, cradling phones and chewing pencils, low voices, patient inquiries, a scene I'd been in myself 1,000 times. They had called Tampa and Atlanta, and by midnight they had gotten hold of a passenger from my bus and the ticket clerk at the Tampa depot. Both of them remembered me. Then they got the bus driver as well. He confirmed he had stopped at the Margrave Cloverleaf to let me out, 8 o'clock Friday morning. By midnight, my alibi was looking rock solid, just like I had said it would be. Saturday morning, a long fax was in from the Pentagon about my service record. 13 years of my life, reduced to a few curling fax pages. It felt like somebody else's life now, but it backed my story. Finley had been impressed by it. Then my prints came back from the FBI database. They had been matched by the tireless computer at 2:30 in the morning. U.S. Army, printed on induction 13 years ago. My alibi was solid, and my background checked out.
Finlay was satisfied, Roscoe told me. You are who you say you are, and midnight Thursday you were over 400 miles away. That was nailed down.
He called the medical examiner again, just in case he had a new opinion on the time of death, but no, midnight was still about right. I shook my head. Finley was one very cautious guy. What about the dead guy? I said. Did you run his prints again? She concentrated on passing a farm truck, the first vehicle we'd seen in a quarter hour. Then she looked across and nodded.
Finley told me you wanted me to, she said. But why?
They came back too quickly for a negative result, I said.
Too quickly?
She said. You told me there was a pyramid system, right? I said. The top 10, then the top 100, then the top 1,000, all the way down, right? She nodded again. So take me as an example, I said. I'm in the database, but I'm pretty low down the pyramid. You just said it took 14 hours to get down to me, right?
Right, she said. I sent your prints in about 12:30 at lunchtime, and they were matched at 2:30 in the morning.
Okay, I said. 14 hours. So if it takes 14 hours to reach nearly to the bottom of the pyramid, it's got to take more than 14 hours to get all the way down to the bottom. That's logical, right?
Right,
she said. But what happened with this dead guy? I said. The body was found at 8 o'clock, so the prints went in when? 8:30, earliest. But Baker was already telling me there was no match on file when they were talking to me at 2:30. I remember the time because I was looking at the clock. That's only 6 hours. If it took 14 hours to find out that I'm in there, how could it take just 6 hours to say the dead guy's not in there?
God, she said. You're right. Baker must have screwed up. Finley took the prints and Baker sent them. He must have screwed up the scan. You gotta be careful, or it doesn't transmit clearly. If the scan's not clear, the database tries to decipher it, then it comes back as unreadable. Baker must have thought that meant a null result. The codes are similar. Anyway, I sent them again first thing. We'll know soon enough.
We drove on east, and Roscoe told me she had pushed Finley to get me out of Warburton right away yesterday afternoon. Finley had grunted and agreed, but there was a problem. They had had to wait until today, because yesterday afternoon Warburton had been just about shut down. They had told Finley there had been some trouble in a bathroom. One convict was dead, one had lost an eye, and a full-scale riot had started, black and white gangs at war. I just sat there next to Roscoe and watched the horizon reeling in. I had killed one guy and blinded another. Now I'd have to confront my feelings. But I didn't feel much at all. Nothing, in fact. No guilt, no remorse, none at all. I felt like I had chased two roaches around that bathroom and stomped on them. But at least a roach is a rational, reasonable, evolved sort of a creature. Those Aryans in that bathroom had been worse than vermin. I had kicked one of them in the throat and he had suffocated on his smashed larynx. Well, tough shit. He started it, right? Attacking me was like pushing open a forbidden door. What waited on the other side was his problem, his risk. If he didn't like it, he shouldn't have pushed open the damn door. I shrugged and forgot about it. Looked over at Roscoe. "Thank you," I said. "I mean it. You worked hard to help me out." She waved away my thanks with a blush and a small gesture and just drove on. I was starting to like her a lot, but probably not enough to stop me getting the hell out of Georgia as soon as I could. Maybe I might just stay an hour or two and then get her to drive me to a bus depot somewhere. "I want to take you to lunch," I said, kind of a thank you thing. She thought about it for a quarter mile and then smiled across at me.
"Okay,"
she said. She jinked the right turn onto the county road and accelerated south toward Margrave, drove past Eno's shiny new place, and headed down to town. 9. I got her to duck in at the station house and bring me out the property bag with my money in it. Then we drove on, and she dropped me in the center of Margrave, and I arranged to meet her up at the station house in a couple of hours. I stood on the sidewalk in the fierce Sunday morning heat and waved her off. I felt a whole lot better. I was back in motion. I was going to check out the blind Blake story, then take Roscoe to lunch, then get the hell out of Georgia and never come back. So I spent a while wandering around looking at the town, doing the things I should have been doing on Friday afternoon. There wasn't really much to the place. The old county road ran straight through, north to south, and for about 4 blocks it was labeled Main Street. Those 4 blocks had small stores and offices facing each other across the width of the road, separated by little service alleys which ran around to the back of the buildings. I saw a small grocery, a barber shop, an outfitter's, a doctor's office, a lawyer's office, and a dentist's office. In back of the commercial buildings was parkland with white picket fences and ornamental trees. On the street, the stores and offices had awnings over wide sidewalks. There were benches set on the sidewalks, but they were empty. The whole place was deserted. Sunday morning, miles from anywhere. Main Street ran north, straight as a die, past a few hundred yards of more parkland up to the station house and the firehouse, and a half mile farther on than that was Eno's diner. A few miles beyond Eno's was the turn west out to Warburton, where the prison was. North of that junction there was nothing on the county road until you reached the warehouses and the highway Cloverleaf, 14 empty miles from where I stood. On the south edge of town I could see a little village green with a bronze statue and a residential street running away to the west. I strolled down there and saw a discreet green sign which read, Beckman Drive, Hubbell's Street. I couldn't see any real distance down it, because pretty much straight away it looped left and right around a wide grass square with a big white wooden church set on it. The church was ringed by cherry trees, and the lawn was circled by cars with clean, quiet paint parked in neat lines. I could just about make out the growl of the organ and the sound of the people singing. The statue on the village green was of a guy called Caspar Thiel, who had done something or other about 100 years ago. More or less opposite Beckman Drive, on the other side of the green, was another residential street, running east, with a convenience store standing alone on the corner. And that was it. Not much of a town. Not much going on. Took me less than 30 minutes to look over everything the place had to offer. But it was the most immaculate town I had ever seen. It was amazing. Every single building was either brand new or recently refurbished. The roads were smooth as glass, and the sidewalks were flat and clean. No potholes, no cracks, no heave. The little offices and stores looked like they got repainted every week. The lawns and the plantings and the trees were clipped to perfection. The bronze statue of old Caspar Thiel looked like somebody licked it clean every morning. The paint on the church was so bright it hurt my eyes. Flags flew everywhere, sparkling white and glowing red and blue in the sun. The whole place was so tidy it could make you nervous to walk around in case you left a dirty footprint somewhere. The convenience store on the southeastern corner was selling the sort of stuff that gave it a good enough excuse to be open on a Sunday morning. Open, but not busy. There was nobody in there except the guy behind the register, but he had coffee. I sat up at the little counter and ordered a big mug and bought a Sunday newspaper. The president was still on the front page. Now he was in California. He was explaining to defense contractors why their gravy train was grinding to a halt after 50 glorious years. The aftershock from his Pensacola announcement about the Coast Guard was still rumbling on. Their boats were returning to their harbors on Saturday night. They wouldn't go out again without new funding. The paper's editorial guys were all stirred up about it. I stopped reading and glanced up when I heard the door open. A woman came in. She took a stool at the opposite end of the counter. She was older than me, maybe 40. Dark hair, very slender, expensively dressed in black. She had very pale skin. So pale it was almost luminous. She moved with a kind of nervous tension. I could see tendons like slim ropes in her wrists. I could see some kind of an appalling strain in her face. The counter guy slid over to her, and she ordered coffee in a voice so quiet I could barely hear it, even though she was pretty close by and it was a silent room. She didn't stay long. She got through half her coffee, watching the window all the time. Then a big black pickup truck pulled up outside, and she shivered. It was a brand new truck, and obviously it had never hauled anything worth hauling. I caught a glimpse of the driver as he leaned over inside to spring the door. He was a tough-looking guy, pretty tall, broad shoulders and a thick neck, black hair all over long knotted arms, maybe 30 years old. The pale woman slid off her stool like a ghost and stood up, swallowed once. As she opened the shop door, I heard the burble of a big motor idling. The woman got into the truck, but it didn't move away, just sat there at the curb. I swiveled on my stool to face the counter guy. "Who is that?" I asked him. The guy looked at me like I was from another planet. "That's Mrs. Kleiner," he said. "You don't know the Kleiners?" "I heard about them," I said. "I'm a stranger in town. Kleiner owns the warehouses up near the highway, right?"
"Right," he said. "And a whole lot more besides.
big deal round here, Mr. Kleiner.
He is?
I said. Sure, the guy said. You heard about the foundation.
I shook my head, finished my coffee, and pushed the mug over for a refill.
Kleiner set up the Kleiner Foundation, the guy said. Benefits the town in a lot of ways. Came here 5 years ago. Been like Christmas ever since.
I nodded. Is Mrs. Kleiner okay? I asked him. He shook his head as he filled my mug.
Ah, she's a sick woman, he said. Very sick. Very pale, right? A very sick woman. Could be tuberculosis. I seen tuberculosis do that to folks. She used to be a fine-looking woman, but now she looks like something grown in a closet, right?
A very sick woman. That's for damn sure.
Who's the guy in the truck? I said.
Stepson, he said.
Kleiner's kid by his first wife. Mrs. Kleiner's his second. I heard she don't get along so good with a kid. He gave me the sort of nod that terminates casual conversations, moved away to wipe off some kind of a chromium machine behind the other end of the counter. The black pickup was still waiting outside. I agreed with the guy that the woman looked like something grown in a closet. She looked like some kind of a rare orchid, starved of light and sustenance. But I didn't agree with him that she looked sick. I didn't think she had tuberculosis. I thought she was suffering from something else, something I'd seen once or twice before. I thought she was suffering from sheer terror. Terror of what I didn't know. Terror of what I didn't want to know. Not my problem. I stood up and dropped a five on the counter. The guy made change all in coins. He had no dollar bills. The pickup was still there, stationary at the curb. The driver was leaning up, chest against the wheel, looking sideways across his stepmother, staring in straight at me. There was a mirror opposite me behind the counter. I looked exactly like a guy who'd been on an all-night bus and then spent 2 days in jail. I figured I needed to get cleaned up before I took Roscoe to lunch. The counter guy saw me, figuring.
"Jai the barber shop," he said.
"On a Sunday?" I said.
The guy shrugged.
"They're always in there," he said. "Never exactly closed.
Never exactly open, either."
I nodded and pushed out through the door. I saw a small crowd of people coming out of the church and chatting on the lawns and getting into their cars. The rest of the town was still deserted, but the black pickup was still at the curb right outside the convenience store. The driver was still staring at me. I walked north in the sun, and the pickup moved slowly alongside, keeping pace. The guy was still hunched forward, staring sideways. I stretched out a couple of steps, and the truck sped up to keep station. Then I stopped dead, and he overshot. I stood there. The guy evidently decided backing up wasn't on his agenda. He floored it and took off with a roar. I shrugged and carried on. Reached the barber shop, ducked under the striped awning and tried the door. Unlocked, I went in. Like everything else in Margrave, the barber shop looked wonderful. It gleamed with ancient chairs and fittings lovingly polished and maintained. It had the kind of barbershop gear everybody tore out 30 years ago. Now everybody wants it back. They pay a fortune for it, because it recreates the way people want America to look, the way they think it used to look. It's certainly the way I thought it used to look.
I would sit in some schoolyard in Manila or Munich and imagine green lawns and trees and flags and a gleaming chrome barber shop like this one. It was run by two old black guys. They were just hanging out there, not really open for business, not really closed. But they indicated they would serve me, like they were there and I was there, so why not? And I guess I looked like an urgent case. I asked them for the works, a shave, a haircut, a hot towel, and a shoe shine. There were framed newspaper front pages here and there on the walls. Big headlines. Roosevelt dies. VJ Day. JFK assassinated. Martin Luther King murdered. There was an old mahogany table radio thumping warmly away. The new Sunday paper was crisply folded on a bench in the window. The old guys mixed up soapy lather in a bowl, stropped a straight razor, rinsed the shaving brush. They shrouded me with towels and got to work. One guy shaved me with the old straight razor. The other guy stood around doing not much of anything. I figured maybe he came into play later. The busy guy started chatting away, like barbers do. Told me the history of his business. The two of them had been buddies since childhood. Always lived here in Margrave since way back. Started out as barbers way before the World War II. Apprenticed in Atlanta. Opened a shop together as young men. Moved it to this location when the old neighborhood was razed. He told me the history of the county from a barber's perspective. Listed the personalities who'd been in and out of these old chairs. Told me about all kinds of people. "So tell me about the Kleiners," I said. He was a chatty guy, but that question shut him up. He stopped work and thought about it. "Can't help you with that inquiry, that's for sure," he said. "That's a subject we prefer not to discuss in here. Best if you ask me about somebody else altogether." I shrugged under the shroud of towels. "Okay," I said. "You ever heard of Blind Blake?"
"Yeah, I heard of, that's for sure," the old man said. "That's a guy we can discuss, no problem at all."
"Great," I said. "So what can you tell me?"
"He was here, time to time, way back," he said. "Born in Jacksonville, Florida, they say, just over the state line. Used to kind of trek on up from there, you know, through here, through Atlanta, all the way up north to Chicago, and then trek all the way back down again, back through Atlanta, back through here, back home. Very different then, you know. No highway. No automobiles, at least not for a poor black man and his friends, all walking or riding on the freight cars."
"You ever hear him play?" I asked him. He stopped work again and looked at me.
"Man, I'm 74 years old," he said. "This was back when I was just a little boy. We're talking about Blind Blake, yeah. Guys like that played in bars. Never was in no bars when I was a little boy, you understand. I would have got my behind whooped real good if I had been." "You should talk to my partner here. He's a whole lot older than I am. He may have heard him play, only he may not remember it. Because he don't remember much, not even what he ate for breakfast. Am I right? Hey, my old friend, what you eat for breakfast?"
The other old guy creaked over and leaned up on the next sink to mine. He was a gnarled old fellow, the color of the mahogany radio.
I don't know what I eat for breakfast, he said. Don't even know if I eat any breakfast at all. But listen up. I may be an old guy, but the truth is, old guys remember stuff real well. Now, recent things, you understand, but old things. You got to imagine your memory is like an old bucket, you know? Once it's filled up with old stuff, there ain't no way to get new stuff in. No way at all, you understand? So I don't remember any new stuff because my old bucket is all filled up with old stuff that happened way back. You understand what I'm saying? Yeah.
Sure, I understand, I said. So, way back, did you ever hear him play?
Who?
He said. I looked at both of them in turn. I wasn't sure whether this was some kind of a rehearsed routine. Blind Blake, I said. Did you ever hear him play?
No, I never heard him play,
the old guy said. But my sister did. Got me a sister more than about 90 years old or thereabouts, may she be spared. Still alive. She did a little singing way back, and she sang with old Blind Blake many a time. She did, I said. She sang with him.
She sure did,
said the gnarled old guy. She sang with just about anybody passing through. You got to remember, this old town lay right on the big road to Atlanta. That old county road out there used to come on down through here, straight on south into Florida. It was the only route through Georgia, north to south. Of course, now you got the highway runs right by without stopping off. And you got airplanes and all. No importance to my grade now. Nobody coming on through anymore. So, Blind Blake stopped off here, I prompted him. And your sister sang with him?
Everybody used to stop off here, he said. North side of town was just pretty much a mess of bars and rooming houses to cater to the folks passing through. All these fancy gardens between here and the firehouse is where the bars and rooming houses used to be. All tore down now, or else all fell down. Been no passing trade at all for a real long time. But back then, it was a different kind of a town altogether. Streams of people in and out the whole time. Workers, crop pickers, drummers, fighters, hobos, truckers, musicians, all kinds of those guys used to stop off and play, and my old sister would be right in there, singing with them all.
And she remembers Blind Blake, I asked him.
She sure does, the old man said. Used to think he was the greatest thing alive. Says he used to play real sporty indeed.
What happened to him? I said. Do you know? The old guy thought hard, trawled back through his fading memories. He shook his grizzled head a couple of times, then he took a wet towel from a hot box and put it over my face, started cutting my hair, ended up shaking his head with some kind of finality.
Can't rightly say, he said.
He came back and forth on the road time to time. I remember that.
pretty well. 3-4 years later, he was gone. I was up in Atlanta for a spell. Wasn't here to know. He'd tell somebody killed him. Maybe right here in my grave, maybe not. Some kind of big trouble. Got him killed stone dead. I sat listening to their old radio for a while. Then I gave them a 20 off my roll of bills and hurried out onto Main Street, strode out north. It was nearly noon and the sun was baking. Hot for September. Nobody else was out walking. The black road blasted heat at me. Blind Blake had walked this road, maybe in the noon heat. Back when those old barbers had been boys, this had been the artery reaching north to Atlanta. Chicago, jobs, hope, money. Noon heat wouldn't have stopped anybody getting where they were going. But now the road was just a smooth, black-top byway, going nowhere at all. It took me a few minutes in the heat to get up to the station house. I walked across its springy lawn, past another bronze statue, and pulled open the heavy glass entrance door. Stepped into the chill inside. Roscoe was waiting for me, leaning on the reception counter. Behind her in the squad room, I could see Stevenson talking urgently into a telephone. Roscoe was pale and looking very worried.
"We found another body," she said.
"Where?" I asked her.
"Up at the warehouse again," she said. "The other side of the road this time, underneath the clover leaf, where it's raised up."
"Who found it?" I said.
"Finley," she said. "He was up there this morning, poking around, looking for something to help us with the first one. Some help, right? All he finds is another one."
"Do you know who this one is?" I asked her. She shook her head.
"Unidentified," she said. "Same as the first one."
"Where's Finley now?" I asked her.
"Gone to get Hubble," she said. "He thinks Hubble may know something about it."
I nodded. "How long was this one up there?" I said.
2 or 3 days, maybe," she said. "Finley says it could have been a double homicide on Thursday night."
I nodded again. Hubble did know something about it. This was the guy he had sent to meet with the tall investigator with the shaved head. He couldn't figure out how the guy had gotten away with it. But the guy hadn't gotten away with it. I heard a car in the lot outside, and then the big glass door sucked open. Finley stuck his head in. "Morg, Roscoe," he said. "You too, Reacha." We followed him back outside into the heat. We all got into Roscoe's unmarked sedan, left Finley's car where he had parked it. Roscoe drove. I sat in the back. Finley sat in the front passenger seat, twisted around so he could talk to the both of us at once. Roscoe nosed out of the police lot and headed south. "I can't find Hubble," Finley said, looking at me. "There's nobody up at his place. Did he say anything to you about going anywhere?" "No," I said. "Not a word. We hardly spoke all weekend." Finley grunted at me. "I need to find out what he knows about all this," he said. "This is serious shit, and he knows something about it, that's for damn sure. What did he tell you about it, Reacher?" I didn't answer. I wasn't entirely sure whose side I was on yet. Finley's, probably. But if Finley started blundering around in whatever Hubble was mixed up in, Hubble and his family were going to end up dead. No doubt about that. So I figured I should just stay impartial and then get the hell out of there as fast as possible. I didn't want to get involved. "You try his mobile number?" I asked him. Finley grunted and shook his head. "Switched off," he said. "Some automatic voice came on and told me."
Did he come by and pick up his watch? I asked him.
His what?
He said. His watch, I said. He left a $10,000 Rolex with Baker on Friday, when Baker was cuffing us for the ride out to Warburton. Did he come pick it up?
No, Finlay said. Nobody said so.
Okay, I said. So he's got some urgent business somewhere. Not even an asshole like Hubble's going to forget about a $10,000 watch, right?
What urgent business? Finlay said. What did he tell you about it?
He didn't tell me diddly, I said. Like I told you, we hardly spoke. Finlay glared at me from the front seat.
Don't mess with me, Reacher, he said.
Until I get hold of Hubble, I'm going to keep hold of you and sweat your ass for what he told you. And don't make out he kept his mouth shut all weekend because guys like that never do. I know that, and you know that. So don't mess with me.
Okay?
I just shrugged at him. He wasn't about to arrest me again. Maybe I could get a bus from wherever the morgue was. I'd have to pass on lunch with Roscoe. Pity.
So what's the story on this one? I asked him.
Pretty much the same as the last one, Finlay said. Looks like it happened at the same time. Shot to death, probably the same weapon. This one didn't get kicked around afterward, but it was probably part of the same incident.
You don't know who it is? I said.
His name is Sherman, he said. Apart from that, no idea.
Tell me about it, I said.
I was asking out of habit. Finlay thought for a moment. I saw him decide to answer, like we were partners.
Unidentified white male, he said. Same deal as the first one. No ID, no wallet, no distinguishing marks. But this one had a gold wristwatch engraved on the back, "To Sherman, Love Judy." He was maybe 30 or 35. Hard to tell, because he'd been lying there for 3 nights, and he was well gnawed by the small animals, you know. His lips are gone and his eyes, but his right hand was okay because it was folded up under his body, so I got some decent prints. We ran them an hour ago, and something may come of that, if we're lucky.
Gunshot wounds? I asked him.
Finlay nodded. Looks like the same gun, he said. Small caliber, soft nose shells. Looks like maybe the first shot only wounded him and he was able to run. He got hit a couple more times, but made it to cover under the highway. He fell down and bled to death. He didn't get kicked around, because they couldn't find him. That's how it looks to me.
I thought about it. I had walked right by there at 8 o'clock on Friday morning, right between the two bodies.
And you figure he was called Sherman, I said.
His name was on his watch, Finlay said.
Might not have been his watch, I said. The guy could have stolen it, could have inherited it. Bought it from a pawn shop, found it in the street.
Finlay just grunted again. We must have been more than 10 miles south of Margrave. Roscoe was keeping up a fast pace down the old county road. Then she slowed and slid down a left fork which led straight to the distant horizon.
Where the hell are we going? I said.
County Hospital, Finlay said. Down in Yellow Springs. Next but one town to the south. Not long now. We drove on. Yellow Springs became a smudge in the heat haze on the horizon. Just inside the town limit was the county hospital, standing more or less on its own. Put there back when diseases were infectious and sick people were isolated. It was a big hospital. A warren of wide, low buildings sprawled over a couple of acres. Roscoe slowed and swung into the entrance lane. We wallowed over speed bumps
and threaded our way around to a spread of buildings clustered on their own and back. The mortuary was a long shed with a big roll-up door standing open. We stopped well clear of the door and left the car in the yard. We looked at each other and went in. A medical guy met us and led us into an office. He sat behind a metal desk and waved Finley and Roscoe to some stools. I leaned on a counter between a computer terminal and a fax machine. This was not a big budget facility. It had been cheaply equipped some years ago. Everything was worn and chipped and untidy, very different from the station house up at Margrave. The guy at the desk looked tired. Not old, not young, maybe Finlay's sort of age. White coat. He looked like the type of guy whose judgment you wouldn't worry about too much. He didn't introduce himself, just took it for granted we all knew who he was and what he was for.
"What can I tell you, folks?" he said.
He looked at all three of us in turn, waited. We looked back.
"Was it the same incident?" Finlay asked.
His deep Harvard tones sounded out of place in the shabby office. The medical guy shrugged at him.
"I've only had the second corpse for an hour," he said. "But yes, I would say it's the same incident. It's almost certainly the same weapon.
Looks like small caliber soft-nose bullets in both cases. The bullets were slow. Looks like the gun had a silencer."
"Small caliber?" I said.
"How small?" The doctor swiveled his tired gaze my way.
"I'm not a firearms expert," he said, "but I'd vote for a .22. Looks that small to me.
I'd say we're looking at soft-nose .22 caliber shells. Take the first guy's head, for example. Two small, splintery entry wounds and two big, messy exit wounds. Characteristic of a small, soft-nosed bullet." I nodded. "That's what a soft-nosed bullet does. It goes in and flattens out as it does so. Becomes a blob of lead about the size of a quarter, tumbling through whatever tissue it meets. Rips a great big exit hole for itself. And a nice, slow, soft-nosed .22 makes sense with a silencer. No point using a silencer except with a subsonic muzzle velocity. Otherwise, the bullet is making its own sonic boom all the way to the target, like a tiny fighter plane."
"Okay," I said. "Were they killed up there where they were found?"
"No doubt about it," the guy said. "Hypostasis is clear in both corpses."
He looked at me, wanted me to ask him what hypostasis was. I knew what it was, but I felt polite, so I looked puzzled for him.
"Post-mortem hypostasis," he said. "Lividity. When you die, your circulation stops, right? Heart isn't beating anymore. Your blood obeys the law of gravity. It settles to the bottom of your body, into the lowest available vessels, usually into the tiny capillaries in the skin next to the floor or whatever you've fallen down onto. The red cells settle first. They stain the skin red. Then they clot, so the stain is fixed, like a photograph. After a few hours, the stains are permanent. The stains on the first guy are entirely consistent with his position on the warehouse forecourt. He was shot. He fell down dead. He was kicked around in some sort of mad frenzy for a few minutes. Then he lay there for around 8 hours. No doubt about it."
"What do you make of the kicking?" Finlay asked him.
The doctor shook his head and shrugged.
"Never seen anything like it," he said.
"I've read about it in the journals, time to time. Some kind of a psychopathic thing, obviously. No way to explain it.
It didn't make any difference to the dead guy. It didn't hurt him because he was dead. So it must have gratified the kicker somehow. Unbelievable fury. Tremendous strength. The injuries are grievous.
What about the second guy? Finley asked.
He ran for it, the doctor said. He was hit close up in the back with the first shot, but it didn't drop him, and he ran. He took two more on the way, one in the neck and the fatal shot in the thigh. Blew away his femoral artery. He made it as far as a raised-up section of highway, then lay down and bled to death. No doubt about that. If it hadn't rained all night Thursday, I'm sure you'd have seen the trail of blood on the road. There must have been about a gallon and a half lying about somewhere, because it sure as hell isn't inside the guy anymore.
We all fell quiet. I was thinking about the second guy's desperate sprint across the road, trying to reach cover while the bullets smashed into his flesh, hurling himself under the highway ramp and dying amid the quiet scuffling of the small night animals.
Okay, Finley said. So we are safe to assume the two victims were together. The shooter is in a group of three. He surprises them, shoots the first guy in the head twice. Meanwhile, the second guy takes off and gets hit by three shots as he runs. Right?
You're assuming there were three assailants? The doctor said.
Finley nodded across to me. It was my theory, so I got to explain it. Three separate personality characteristics, I said. A competent shooter, a frenzied maniac, and an incompetent concealer. The doctor nodded slowly.
I buy that, he said.
The first guy was hit at point-blank range, so maybe we should assume he knew the assailants and allowed them to get next to him?
Finley nodded.
Had to be that way, he said. Five guys meeting together, three of them attack the other two. This is some kind of a big deal, right?
Do we know who the assailants were? The doctor asked.
We don't even know who the victims were, Roscoe said.
Got any theories on the victims? Finley asked the doctor.
Not on the second guy, apart from the name on his watch, the doctor said. I only just got him on the table an hour ago.
So you got theories on the first guy? Finley said.
The doctor started shuffling some notes on his desk, but his telephone rang. He answered it and then held it out to Finley.
For you, he said.
Finley crouched forward on his stool and took the call, listened for a moment.
Okay, he said into the phone. Just print it out and fax it to us here, will you?
Then he passed the phone back to the doctor and rocked back on his stool. He had the beginnings of a smile on his face.
That was Stevenson, up at the station house, he said. We finally got a match on the first guy's prints. Seems like we did the right thing to run them again. Stevenson's faxing it through to us here in a minute. So tell us what you got, Doc, and we'll put it all together.
The tired guy in the white coat shrugged and picked up a sheet of paper.
The first guy, he said, I haven't got much at all. The body was in a hell of a mess. He was tall, he was fit, he had a shaved head. The main thing is the dental work. Looks like the guy got his teeth fixed all over the place. Some of it is American, some of it looks American, some of it is foreign.
Next to my hip, the fax machine started beeping and whirring. A sheet of thin paper fed itself in.
So what do we make of that? Finley said. The guy was foreign? Or an American who lived abroad, or what?
The thin sheet of paper fed itself out, covered in writing. Then the machine stopped and went quiet. I picked up the paper and glanced at it. Then I read it through twice. I went cold. I was gripped by an icy paralysis, and I couldn't move. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing on that piece of fax paper. The sky crashed in on me. I stared at the doctor and spoke. "He grew up abroad," I said. "He had his teeth fixed wherever he was living. He broke his right arm when he was 8 and had it set in Germany. He had his tonsils out in the hospital and so on." The doctor looked up at me. "They can tell all that from his fingerprints?" he said. I shook my head. "The guy was my brother," I said. 10. Once I saw a Navy film about expeditions in the frozen Arctic. You could be walking over a solid glacier. Suddenly the ice would heave and shatter. Some kind of unimaginable stresses in the floes. A whole new geography would be forced up. Massive escarpments where it had been flat. Huge ravines behind you. A new lake in front of you. The world. All changed in a second. That's how I felt. I sat there rigid with shock on the counter between the fax machine and the computer terminal and felt like an Arctic guy whose whole world changes in a single step. They walked me through to the cold store and back to make a formal identification of his body. His face had been blown away by the gunshots, and all his bones were broken, but I recognized the star-shaped scar on his neck. He'd got it when we were messing with a broken bottle 29 years ago. Then they took me back up to the station house in Margrave. Finley drove. Roscoe sat with me in the back of the car and held my hand all the way. It was only a 20-minute ride, but in that time I lived through 2 whole lifetimes, his and mine. My brother, Joe, 2 years older than me. He was born on a base in the Far East, right at the end of the Eisenhower era. Then I had been born on a base in Europe, right at the start of the Kennedy era. Then we'd grown up together all over the world inside that tight, isolated transience that service families create for themselves. Life was all about moving on at random and unpredictable intervals. It got so that it felt weird to do more than a semester and a half in any one place. Several times we went years without seeing a winter. We'd get moved out of Europe at the start of the fall and go down to the Pacific somewhere, and summer would begin all over again. Our friends kept just disappearing. Some unit would get shipped out somewhere, and a bunch of kids would be gone. Sometimes we saw them again, months later, in a different place. Plenty of them we never saw again. Nobody ever said hello or goodbye. You were just either there or not there. Then as Joe and I got older, we got moved around more. The Vietnam thing meant the military started shuffling people around the world faster and faster. Life became just a blur of bases. We never owned anything. We were only allowed 1 bag each on the transport planes. We were together in that blur for 16 years. Joe was the only constant thing in my life, and I loved him like a brother. But that phrase has a very precise meaning. A lot of those stock sayings do. Like, when people say they slept like a baby, do they mean they slept well? Or do they mean they woke up every 10 minutes screaming? I loved Joe like a brother, which meant a lot of things in our family. The truth was, I never knew for sure if I loved him or not, and he never knew for sure if he loved me or not either. We were only 2 years apart, but he was born in the 50s and I was born in the 60s. That seemed to make a lot more than 2 years worth of a difference to us. And like any pair of brothers, 2 years apart, we irritated the hell out of each other. We fought and bickered and sullenly waited to grow up and get out from under. Most of those 16 years, we didn't know if we loved each other or hated each other. But we had the thing that army families have. Your family